I'm Darius Larson. I'm a campus minister at the University of New Mexico in Albuquerque for the Lutheran Church. And today's session is Living Epistles of Hope. And it's going to be on Pierre Teilhard de Chardin. And I'd like to start off by going a roundabout way, sharing a little bit about a concept that I discovered a few years ago that has meant a lot to me, inner companions. The term inner companions, I've been known to ask people out of the blue, who are some of your inner companions? And they don't know where I'm coming from. I have now found out that that's not a good thing to do because it makes people nervous. But it's a way of, for me to try to figure out who another person is by finding out in what way I and they may have inner companions in common. An inner companion is that person that may be living or dead, maybe an author, a poet, maybe just somebody you know, who has become so much a part of you that you find yourself possibly quoting that person without really giving credit to the person. That person has been digested into you. Now, on the outset, I want to say I wish I could say that about Teilhard de Chardin, but he is so complex and so full of so much that there's only kind of a spirit of Teilhard that I hope has been digested into me, and all of what he stands for is has not yet been totally digested into myself. How many of you have either read or heard somebody else speak about Teilhard in the past? Several people. Okay, now, you cannot answer this next question. Those of you who did not raise your hand, when you think of the word evolution, what sort of images or thoughts come to your mind when you hear the word evolution? Anything about in the news lately, too, about evolution that you've been reading about? I get totally fed up with newscasts and titles of books that talk about evolution versus creationism, as if it's an either-or proposition. Hopefully today you'll be finding at least, if nothing else, a third alternative to that either-or. There is a kind of a both-and in there. But I'd like to share, first of all, a story with you that was shared by a Jean Houston about herself when she was a very small child. She's probably about 8 or 9 years old, living in New York City. She was on her way home from school, and she decided to sit down or lay down in Central Park and a day like today, look up where there were puffy clouds and start imagining what that world in the sky must be like. She got so enraptured by that that she didn't realize that an old man of about 73 years old laid down beside her or next to her and asked her, "What are you looking at?" And she started sharing with him what she saw. And to make a long story short, the friendship developed. She would look for this person every time coming home from school. And he started sharing with her his imagination and how they would get right down on their hands and knees and sometimes lay face down in the ground and look into the grass and see all sorts of worlds in those blades of grass, seeing ants crawling up and down and over. And they were both just full of life and full of vitality, and there was a whole new world out there for her to see. All of the world was alive with wonder, as this person told her. One day he did not show up. The next day he did not, and the next day he did not. So she went to where she saw him go, into this house across from Central Park, and knocked on the door and asked where this man was. And she found out that he had died on Easter Sunday in the year of 1955. This person was Pierre Teilhard de Chardin. She discovered some 20 years later. To try to separate Teilhard's life with Teilhard's thought is doing an injustice not only to Teilhard, but almost everything that Teilhard believes about who and what God is all about. Because Teilhard was basically, as someone described him once, a garment without seams. It's very hard to cut him up and say, this part is his life, this part is his thought. However, I'm going to perform a brief heresy there and try to separate it in those two ways today. He was a priest, a poet, a paleontologist, a mystic, a man of just all sorts of abilities. Three reasons why we should, rediscover him again. This is the first time I've really talked about him in about 8 years. Is that last year, as you can tell by he died in 1881, that last year was his centennial year, and a few journals and a few books came out once again to kind of try to revitalize ourselves with the thought of Teilhard. And also, when we were sitting around last Sunday in our teaching staff meetings, we were trying to think of who would be a good person to share this afternoon in Living the Politics of Hope. And there's probably nobody that sums up to me what hope is all about more than Teilhard. And so I said, has anybody thought of doing Teilhard? And they go, you do it. So here I am, 8 years later, redoing Teilhard. And also the question of the evolution and creationists, the split, that battle in public schools. In Albuquerque, I sit on a committee on teaching about religion in the public schools, and they're paranoid about what's going to be happening, how the courts are going to decide that issue. And so it was good for me to get re-involved with Teilhard. By the way, Pierre is his first name. If you go to the library for a book, you look under Teilhard, unless they don't know what they're doing. Then you look under Chardin. I used to think that it was Pierre Teilhard of Chardin, some sort of province or town. But I found out in reading some other place this week that Chardin was his maternal grandmother, and you can have real long names, so somehow that got connected. I'm not sure about all of that. I still kind of think it has something to do with a town that he or his family comes from, but that's maybe connected with who his grandmother is too. I'm not sure. But first name Pierre, last name Teilhard when you're trying to find him in the library. If you don't find him under Teilhard, then look under Chardin. Born May 1st in central France, he was the fourth of 11 children. His mother was a pious, simple, saintly person. Just a gentle spirit. And his father was a very fine scholar of Latin and earth sciences. And Teilhard, from the very beginning, saw a split in his parents, and some people have tried to deal with that to see if his need to bring those two together was a need to bring his father and mother together, or who he was as a person together. Pierre thought that one should stand in awe and in wonder and love for the physical world, for it comes from God. It was an object of adoration. And nothing turns a person who is in the physical sciences on faster than to start sharing about Teilhard if they're not already aware of him. Because he called research form of adoration. And he went about his scientific research as a way of adoring the God who made all. He was fed up with all sorts of dualistic splits that we have encountered and continue to encounter through our lives. The soul, body, faith, knowledge, religion, science, mind, matter. He says, I quote, "There are two spirits within my heart that fight with each other and tear me apart. The yearning to bring them together is born out of a pain and I wish the separation would vanish like a fog before the rising sun. He was a priest and he was a scientist, but it was not a dual role. He was not a sometimes priest and sometimes scientist. He was both and priest scientist. In 1911, he was ordained. He was chaplain in World War I, a stretcher bearer on the front lines. He refused, by the way, just a side light, he refused to be promoted in any rank. He felt that was not the calling of a Christian. You should radically identify with those people who you are serving. In 1921, he wrote a short article entitled Science and Christ, which kind of set the stage, one of the few articles that was able to be published during his lifetime that had anything to do with the science and Christ connection. The scientific study of matter, he said, can and should serve to lift one to the divine center. Many people in the scientific circles laughed. Many people in the scientific circle didn't really understand where Teilhard was coming from. In 1923, he went to China, one of several trips. In fact, he spent much of his life there, wrote many other scientific papers. He was, by the way, one of the people who was the principal discoverer of the Peking Man. Plus, he wrote a spiritual classic, one that I think is still in the bookstore, called The Divine Milieu, The Divine Environment. It's probably one of the better introductions to his religious, science, mystic, poetic side of him. Beautiful little book that takes just time to relax into. He said, I have settled down to the little book I plan. I want to write it slowly, quietly, living it and meditating on it like a prayer. Just one quote from it. Let us only believe. May we believe the harder and the more despairingly, as reality seems the more threatening and irreducible. And then, little by little, we shall see the universal horror relax and smile at us and enfold us in more than human arms. This was a testament of his faith, but one of the major setbacks was it took 30 years for it to get published. And if you're good at arithmetic, that's 2 years after he had died. In fact, most of his works were published after his death. As Gary Pence shared a couple nights ago, I think now, about the term seeding history, I think Teilhard was a person who was about seeding history, trying to point out a different direction than what we normally would think history would be moving. And he had an imaginative spirit that wouldn't quit. And this excited people, and it worried the church. Two principles guided him. He said, we must dare all. He said this when he was on the front lines as a stretcher bearer. He said it when he went up in front of intellectuals, and he said it when he went up before the church. We must dare all without fear. The second principle was that he says, I go towards him who comes. He was confident in his vision, so confident that upon trying to get the phenomenon of the man, which I'll speak about a little bit later here, accepted by the Roman Catholic Church, he says in a letter, on reflection, I thought the best way was to satisfy the censor's demands without any distortion, of course, of my thought. But by going through the text, dotting the I's and crossing the T's, in footnotes and also in dozens of pages which are now ready of epilogue, which seems to me useful, I think these retouchings have improved my original draft. Needless to say, he was not about to change the content of his message, but only the probably grammatical structure of his message. He was, some people call it, banished or exiled to China. The only problem was he viewed himself as a world citizen. And therefore, when you consider yourself a citizen of a world, of the world, it's very hard to find a place to be banished to. In 1940, he finished his, I hate to use the words calling this a spiritual classic and this a scientific classic because it breaks everything that Teilhard stands for. But this is a little, this is where he lays out his viewpoint of the of the evolutionary way of moving in the world. It's called The Phenomenon of Man. And in completing it, he said, "I feel that I have seldom worked so entirely for God alone." 8 years later, he thought it was ready for him to try to see if the church would allow him to publish it. Not only did the Vatican say no to publishing The Phenomenon of Man, but they also said no to letting him accept the highest academic post that France would offer, a professorship at the College of France. In dealing with all of this, in another writing letter, he writes, "I have decided to continue as before, trusting to the good fortune, or rather the legitimacy of my cause. I know that is what all the heretics said, but for the most part, they did not take up their position solely to exalt Christ above all things. And basically, that is the only charge that can be brought against me." In weaker moments, however, like in a letter in 1951, he asked a friend of his to pray for him, "That I may not pray for me, that I may not die embittered." In 1951, he moves to New York. And in April 10th, 1955, with only a few rather purely scientific papers published, he dies of a heart attack at the age of 73. By the way, this is a beautiful book in the library. Photographs and everything else with nice quotes, and if you just want to page through it and sense the flavor of Teilhard, please do so. It's unreserved, it shouldn't be taken out of the library, but I think I got special permission. I didn't ask, but I just.
I'm watching you, though.
Uh-oh. Serves me right, I got down page 213, and there's two. Okay. March 1955, remember he died in April 1955, he says, "One would think that a single ray of this kind of light falling anywhere on the Newell sphere," the term we've been getting into, the mind sphere, the thinking layer of the universe, "as a spark would cause an explosion strong enough to inflame and transform the face of the earth almost instantaneously. How then can it be that I, looking around me, still intoxicated by what has been shown to me, should find myself alone, as it were, the only one of my species, the only one to have seen, so unable, when asked, to cite a single author, a single text, which might clearly describe the marvelous transluence that has so transfigured everything that I see. However, if the truth appears once, in one single mind, that is enough to ensure that nothing can ever prevent it from spreading to everything and setting it ablaze." So it was in the early 60s. Vatican II. His books were still not supposed to be read. He did a wise thing. Many of his manuscripts he gave to non-Catholics. And so they were able to get them published after his death. And he was probably the most quoted of the people you were not supposed to quote in Vatican II. He probably had as much influence on Vatican II as John the 23rd did. Harald Rahner was one person that is deeply indebted to him. But now, the question becomes, what outraged the world so much? What outraged the church basically so much that they were scared of what Teilhard was saying? And I don't know if any of you have ever seen the term, everything that rises must converge. Where have you seen that before? Flannery O'Connor. It's one of her, I think, short stories or very short novels that is taken from a saying of Teilhard, which kind of encapsulates, I think, his thought. Everything that rises must converge. Science, though, said basically that God doesn't belong in this evolutionary process. It's an oversimplification. And the church basically said that science doesn't belong to our God story, an oversimplification. But Teilhard said that truth is truth wherever you find it. And wherever you find it, you must speak it. I quote, "Evolution, which offers a passage to something that escapes total death, is the hand of God drawing us to himself. For evolution is a light illuminating all facts, a curve that all lines must follow." What outraged the world was Teilhard's view of the world as it was evolving. He yearned to bring, you see, the sciences and the Christian faith together, and it was born of pain. But evolution is the formula where all contradictions, he says, are reconciled. And the problem with the world is one of vision. In Christian circles, God, somewhat even subconsciously or unconsciously, God is out there on high. And he is really not for us within or ahead. And for in scientific circles, evolution was change, but change without direction. There was no meaning to the meaning. Christians, therefore, viewed evolution one of two ways. They either ignored it or they denied it. And by denying it, it was a form of anti-intellectualism that, if we watch some of the court cases today, is still alive and well and living in the United States. Teilhard cuts through this all. He cuts through it by saying that the problem with the world, as we try to understand it, or the problem with humanity as they try to understand the world, is that they don't look at the world. An illustration to break this down, which wasn't Teilhard's, and I don't know where it came from. If you take the Empire State Building and you place upon the Empire State Building a book, and you place on top of the book a dime, the face, the impression on the dime is, let me put it, all of that is therefore, since time began to the present, is from the dime down to the ground level of the Empire State Building. The face on top of the dime is recorded history. The dime is since life began, since humanity was around. The book is since all life began. The rest of the 102 or 100 and whatever stories is the rest of matter, the rest of time in the creation of this world. 99% of all studying and trying to understand this world is centered upon the dying. Teilhard says we must look deeper. We must look within to see how and in what way God is speaking to us through all of creation. And he says that, I don't know if he would still say it today, but Earth is basically 5 to 10,000 billion years old. And we look at the last few centuries and we try to make conclusions from it. The divine powers at work are directing the natural process to its goal, he says. Atoms become molecules, molecules become megamolecules, megamolecules become organisms, and it moves on and on and on to the highest point. It's when matter becomes conscious of itself. That's the neural sphere that I have up there. It's the thinking layer that envelops this earth, in which creation comes to a point that it knows that it is a creation. The human brain exists. We then become God's co-creators, God's junior partners in the driving life into the future. We need to accept this grace event, he says, and discover the basic energy in which all and all other energies are merely servants. Thus, we need to discover the real moving force behind evolution. I remember through all of this, discovering the Peking Man, doing all sorts of excavations in China and Southern Africa, and he was even in Glacier Park here in the early 50s and down in the Grand Canyon. He was a firm believer, as I said before, that research is adoration. God calls me to be responsible with God for the process of creation. And I can't help, as we reflect on the anniversary now of the birth of St. Francis, how similar a vision that St. Francis has had about uniting all creation. You can just read his Canticle to the Sun, I think it's in our hymn book, number 527, and get a feel for maybe what Teilhard was feeling, although St. Francis wrote it several hundred years earlier. How does the development look? In one way of saying it, we could say that at one point there was non-life, then it moved to plant life, animal life, human life, and then the omega point, which I will get into. Another way that he likes to describe it is looking at the different spheres that were created in and around this planet Earth. There's the barysphere, that hot molten core within the Earth. There's the lithosphere, the Earth's crust. And then there's the hydrosphere, the sphere of water that's within the lithosphere. And then there is also the atmosphere. But he also talks about the biosphere, that sphere around the Earth, which is full of life. And then, and it's the term that he coined, there is the neural sphere. That mind sphere, in which we don't only reflect on the fact that we reflect, but I reflect on the fact that you reflect. And that the noosphere, some examples of the noosphere in a very literal sense nowadays, is all these telecommunication networks all over the place, these sound waves going all over the place. It is literally a sphere of the mind that's engulfing the world. And then he also talks about the crystal sphere, the sphere that is the sphere of the omega point in which all is united in Christ. There's hope in the spheres. There's hope in them because he said once that if the earth was flat, there would be no hope for us. But because the earth is round, we move out to get away from people, to get away from things, but we come back upon ourselves again and again. He says, we have reached our end point. We have reached the end point of a diverging stage of history in which, when we didn't get along, we went west. Go west, young man, you know, to the newness. We have now entered a converging stage, a stage of life in which we come back upon ourselves. And therefore, he says, in this other nice little book, Building the Earth, it's easy to read. It's just, it has even different colors in it. But it's basically a poem on building the earth. But the ages of nations have passed. But the task before us, if we will not perish, is to shake off our ancient prejudices and build the earth. And we have to do that, otherwise we will perish because of the spherical nature of the earth. There is, what he says, the law of complexity consciousness. It's matter which moves towards complexity corresponds to an equal rise in consciousness. As some evolutionists call mutations as being accidents, Teilhard does not believe so. He says that the arrow of the phenomenon of man, humankind, flies goal-directed. It's kind of a rocket with stages. There is a groping process in which you run into dead ends as there's offshoots of life. But they keep groping and groping and groping until purpose is achieved. It's kind of like, I don't know if any of you, what are those, the rubric cubes? There was a rubric? Rubik cube. I mean, some people aren't as random, but I do it randomly. And I'm trying to figure it out, and I'm groping around, and as I do it long enough, all of a sudden there seems to be some sort of purpose in that. And so, you know, I haven't discovered and unlocked the mystery of it yet, but I'm starting to see directions. You got to work at the corners and bring them in, and some of you can do it probably much faster. So they're not only just blind alleys. The blind alleys only slow the process down. You back up and start over again until you have an aha experience, a eureka. This is what God intends us to be. And when humankind first reflected that they were human, that was a eureka or an aha experience. Now the movement is a movement all moving towards point omega. Nothing is lost at omega. All is gathered in. All in all becomes conscious. We are just in an embryonic state. Now here's where, if you're a Christian, it's okay. If you're a scientist, it's okay. But when you get into this mystical stuff, it's another leap to try to envision what he's talking about. We are moving towards a new creation, a kingdom of God, in which all is connected through an interconnectedness. Not only are my hands, my fingers a part of my hand, a part of my arm, a part of my body, but at point omega, I am part of you, and you are part of me, as my fingers are now part of me. We become all in one and one in all. There is no Greek, no Jew, nor gay, nor straight, nor black, nor white, but we become that which we are. We become the point omega in which everything is conscious of itself, and at this point, that means conscious of God and God of self. 1954, Teilhard says, was year one of the newest sphere. You know what happened in 54? That was the geological survey year in which, for the first time, I think he said, he felt in all recorded history, every nation cooperated in one event. That is year one of this coming together. Now, with he talks about, you know, the satellites in the air and the communication systems and things like this, we can even be a beholder and get TV. Amazing. It may not be too good, but it's amazing that you can get it. Salvation, then, for Teilhard means that you don't abandon the world, but you become an active participant in the building up of that world. Remember, the ages of nations have passed. Our task is to build the earth together, to get rid of our prejudices, to get rid of our biases, because basically, we are lonely people in search of union with others. And as we know that, we can meditate upon that union and come closer and closer and closer to point of nature. Now, the temptation is that we don't want to search beyond ourselves. We don't want to stretch ourselves. We don't want to move out and move out and move out because it's too difficult. We want to rebel. We want to be satisfied with our own self-knowledge. And probably an unfair use of Jean-Paul Sartre, I'd like to share a little illustration with you from his play No Exit. In his play No Exit, those of you who are familiar with it, we're all in a room, maybe not quite this many, but we're all in a room and there's no way out. And we all can't stand each other. We're fed up with each other. If only we could get out of here and be ourselves someplace else. But this is hell and it's going to go on for eternity. So goes the play. Now my interpretation is that when the door opens down towards the end of the play, they look out and they see this dark abyss, this unknown. And their choice is, should they risk the unknown and move out into that black unknown world to get rid of this which they call hell? Or do you choose to remain in your hell because at least you know what that is? And those of you who know the play, they decide to close the door and remain in their hell because they can't trust that which is out there. Now, to use that with Teilhard, I would say, and with evolution, and how often have we heard about those animals in the muck? The swamp is drying up. It's hell. It's miserable. And over the horizon, there may be a lake. And you have to learn to stretch yourself to move out in order to develop. And how many species have gone extinct because they were unwilling to trust and move out, and they shut the door behind them. But Teilhard says, moving from the noosphere to the crystal sphere, which is moving towards the point omega, is that we have to learn to stretch ourselves and rise up out of the muck of the universe into a larger light. We have to understand our aloneness. We have to seek then the union. That energy which seeks such union is what he calls the within of things. There is something within me that longs for me to be united with others. St. Francis had the vision of being united with all things. Teilhard had that vision. We may have limited visions of being united with 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7 other people living in community. Here we're saying that it's a much larger dream than that. We're going to be united with all that there is. Now this would be impossible. Oh, one other thing. Karl Rahner, who's been influenced by Teilhard, talks about, here's a loose paraphrase, is that the task for us is not to cram the Holy Spirit down someone else's throat, but to allow the Holy Spirit that rests within them to emerge out of themselves. That's I would say, somewhat Teilhardian. But this would all be impossible without the incarnation. The incarnation, that God's will be done despite our wanting to abuse our freedom. The noosphere only hints at our call, but now, with the incarnation, we can see that God wishes also to unite him or herself in all of creation. Communion is the foretaste of the feast to come, when God is in all. Now we see God in the bread and in the wine. Teilhard's hope and Teilhard's dream is that we will see God in all. Let me share just a couple of things here from here's a prayer of Teilhard's, the spiritual power of matter. Blessed be you, harsh matter, barren soil, stubborn rock. You who would yield only to violence, you who force us to work if we would eat. Blessed be you, perilous matter, violent sea, untamable passion. You who, unless we fetter, you will devour us. Blessed be you, mighty matter, irresistible march of evolution, reality ever newborn. You, by constantly shattering our material mental categories, force us to go even further and further in the pursuit of truth. Blessed be you, universal matter, immeasurable time, boundless ether, triple abyss of stars and atoms and generations. You who, by overflowing and dissolving our narrow standard of measurement, reveal to us the dimensions of God. And one other one. This is in the Divine Milieu. To begin with, in action, I adhere to the creative power of God. I coincide with it. I become not only its instrument, but its living extension. And as there is nothing more personal in a being than his will, I merge myself, in a sense, through my heart, with the very heart. Teilhard's vision of the world is one that is so powerfully huge that if we don't like it, we don't have to accept it. Because he says nothing drastic will come about in any major sense, he says, for another 1 million, 2 million years, which is a very short time, very short time. We get so wrapped up in the smallness of life that we become fearful of that smallness. And what Teilhard says, if we can see that life larger, we don't have to be fearful of the smallness of life. And then we can work as part of that groping. And what you can be empowered to love your neighbor, to serve them, to clothe them. So living the politics of hope, for me, is to see that guiding principle that's throughout all of creation, that God's will be done. And to know that and to believe that, that should empower us to join in that creation in a new, radical way that before we were just too scared to do because we were all wrapped up in our own little security blankets, thinking that the world will come to end if I do this or do that. And the last thing that I just want to say is that when it comes into creationism versus evolutionism, in the public schools, but the creationists, I believe, have a too restrictive view of who God is.
God is much grander than the creationists want God to be. They want to create God in their image rather than the other way around. To talk to physicists, to geologists, to other people at the University of New Mexico, and to see them do research, which is fun. I'll never forget just a quick little side light. Faith, Science, and Culture, Lutheran Student Movement put out a little study packet to deal with this concept. And I had some of our people at the university take a look at it. And they said, you know, the only problem with this is that nowhere do they say research is fun. You have to be so serious about it all the time. There was one way for this person to say that research can be fun. Research can be a way of me of enjoying who and what God created me to be. Now, there are other problems with all of that, and what type of research do you do, and the ethical dimensions and all that. It's not what we're about, I don't think, right here today. But that, I think, Teilhard offers for us not only a vision of hope, which is where he becomes my inner companion, but he also offers us a way to see the universe, which stretches me, and I'm still stretching. And he says, just catch on to the vision. If you find errors in my work and everything else, improve upon them, change them. They're not meant to be static and constant. They're meant to be evolving too. So work at them, play with them, evolve with them. So goes Teilhard de Chardin. I would say those of you who have read Teilhard too, join in here, but I would say that grace is there by the matter of us existing. So grace is offered based on just, I'm here, God has given me life, and he's given it to me unconditionally. There's been some talk about whether or not how he deals with evil, which is different than grace, but there's where some people have had some hard time accepting him. Except for he very seldom gets into a personalistic, individualistic I right. In dealing with that. The universe is moving towards grace, or moving towards God, so it's a much more of a concept of we-ness than I-ness. So it's hard. When I bring it down to my level, which is I-ness, then I, what you're saying, I would say, but I think Teilhard moves out there somewhere, and this is where this mystical stuff just excites me and confuses me.
Yeah.
Does he say anything about the rapture? Not that I know of. I've never run across it, so I would not think so. Pardon me? That is Point Omega?
I mean, that's the
Yeah, that's a good point. But I would think what he would call is Point Omega and define it, and what they would call Point Omega and define it would be two different visions of Point Omega.
What is your definition of that third Genesis?
Oh, okay. Well, that's basically the same word for the crystal sphere. It's the becoming Christ. It's the process moving towards Point Omega, in which the Christ, in fact, Christ is the main stem of the evolutionary process. We need to know a touchstone as far as where and how we are moving in this process. Our reference point is Jesus, who was the Christ back in, the turn of eight BC AD, and it was probably the turn of the century, the turn of whatever that is. And the Christogenesis would be us becoming one with Christ, which is what the Point Omega is. It's that total union with Christ. And other people have faulted Teilhard, I should say, in getting into a pantheism in which all is one and one is all and all of this, but he is so Christ-centered, you might be able to consider it a Christ-centered pantheism, but then I wonder if it's a pantheism. So, I don't know. And I don't know. Any other thought? Any other? Well, by the way, the Hymn of the Universe is just another little book which just kind of gives his praise, as I would say St. Francis would, his canticle to the sun. Of his hymn of celebration to that which God has given us. This is his statement of grace in that sense. So. Well, thank you so much.
Thank you.